I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen. She's joined in conversation by Sue Fishkoff, editor of J, the Jewish News of Northern California. And now join Barbara Lane on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Masha Gessen and Sue Fishkoff.
Masha Gessen is a courageous, insightful Russian-American journalist and LGBT activist known for her opposition to President Vladimir Putin. She was last here at the JCCSF for her book, The Brothers, all about the Tsarnaev brothers who were behind the Boston Marathon bombings. Her other books include The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, and Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, The New York Times, The New York Review of Books, Slate, and many other publications. Masha is here tonight with her new book, Where the Jews Aren't, the sad and absurd story of Birobidzhan, Russia's Jewish autonomous region. The idea of an autonomous Jewish region was championed by Jewish communists and intellectuals who envisioned a haven of post-oppression Jewish culture. By the mid-1930s, tens of thousands of Soviet Jews, as well as about 1,000 Jews from abroad, had moved there. To say it didn't exactly pan out as expected is an understatement. So we'll hear all about that from Masha. Following the presidential election, Masha Gessen wrote a widely read article, retweeted and covered by Rachel Maddow and many others, for the New York Review of Books called Autocracy, Rules for Survival, about surviving in an autocracy and salvaging your sanity and self-respect, drawing on her experience living in Vladimir Putin's Russia. We are pleased to be able to add her bold, fiercely intelligent voice to the post-election discussion here at the JCCSF. Masha Gessen appears tonight in conversation with Sue Fishkoff, editor of J, the Jewish News Weekly of Northern California. Please join me in welcoming them both.
Hello, Masha. Hello, and I'm Sue Fishkoff, and I'm very honored to be here in conversation with Masha Gessen. I was here last year when she spoke, and I'm a fan of her writing, and I'm very excited to have this conversation with her and with you tonight. As Barbara said, Masha is right now on tour with her new book, Where the Jews Aren't, the sad and absurd story of Birobidzhan, Russia's Jewish autonomous region. And we're going to talk about that book first and then move to talking about Putin and move to talking about the election of Trump and the essay that she wrote last week in the New York Review of Books. But I do want to turn to this marvelous little book first and this topic, because there are parallels to be drawn between all three topics. Joseph Stalin, upon whose order Birobidzhan was created ostensibly as a Jewish national homeland 75 years ago, there are parallels that can be drawn between him as an autocrat and the totalitarian regime that he headed, and Putin, who is the head of Russia today, and there are parallels that Masha has drawn between Putin and Donald Trump, our president-elect. So we will talk about all of that, but I do first want to turn to this book and to the story of Birobidzhan. Birobidzhan, godforsaken place in the Russian Far East. You call it the worst good idea ever in your book, and I think that's a marvelous way to explain it, to describe it. I'd like you to talk about, what is Birobidzhan? Why was it created? Who came there? And why was it such a good, bad idea?
Thank you. I should point out that this is probably the highest concentration of people who have been to Birobidzhan that has ever gathered in the United States, because both of us have been to Birobidzhan.
I was there for the 70th anniversary, and you were there 5 years later. I was there in 2004. You were there in 2009. So we'll compare some of the people that we met in good old times.
So Birobidzhan, the Jewish Autonomous Region, was conceived in the 1920s because the original Soviet project presupposed that the nationalities would all it was the anti-imperial empire, right? So it was internationalist in spirit, and that meant that every nationality had to have an equal piece of the pie, and that meant it had to have its own territory in which it had a cultural autonomy. And of course, because this was an anti-religious empire, the Jews were a nationality. It was an ethnic group like any other, and so they needed a territory. And the people, the territory that seemed most suitable was the one in the far, far east on the border with contested Manchuria at the time, now China. Not a terribly hospitable place. But the people who went there were mostly desperate Jews from what had been the Pale of Settlement. Because what had happened in 1917 with the Bolshevik Revolution was that on the one hand, the limits on Jewish citizenship were lifted overnight, right? Jews were allowed to live anywhere, hold any job, all these restrictions that had been in place for more than 100 years were lifted. On the other hand, private enterprise became illegal very soon. And of course, all the Jews, or virtually all the Jews, in what had been the Pale of Settlement, what is now Belarus and Ukraine, had been small tradesmen. They had not worked the land. They had all been in private enterprise. And so they were elevated to full citizenship and impoverished at the very same time. And Birobidzhan seemed the answer to many of those people, especially because they got a subsidized one-way ticket. And they were told that they would be able to go there and work the land and be thereby productivized by working the land. And the first shipment came to Birobidzhan in 1928, and people continued to settle there until the first purges hit in 1934.
And some American Jewish communists answered the call as well to Birobidzhan. There was in Petaluma, right near here, there were right after the First World War, it was a Jewish socialist farm. And when Birobidzhan was created, some about 10 or 12 families went to Palestine, to kibbutzim, and about 10 or 12 families went to Birobidzhan. So who were these Americans who went? And some of the writings today about Birobidzhan have this kind of nostalgic view and talk about the heroic pioneers who answered the call to go there, and too bad it was a doomed experiment. Do you see anything sort of glorious or heroic in any of the people who went there in their ideals, or was it just doomed to fail from the beginning?
Oh, sure, they were glorious and heroic. I mean, you know, I don't, full disclosure, I don't find glorious and heroic to be terribly appealing qualities, but I did think that the idea of autonomism was a fascinating and wonderful idea and very poetic. And so a character in the book is somebody who never had anything to do with Birobidzhan itself. It's Shimon Dubnov, or Simon Dubno, as he's spelled in English, a wonderful, nearly forgotten turn-of-the-century Jewish historian and thinker who originated the idea of autonomism. And his argument was that the Jews had achieved sort of the pinnacle of nationhood. He was an evolutionist. He was writing, you know, it wasn't that long after Darwin, the Darwinian Revolution, so he was writing very much in those terms. And so in his universe, the lowest stage of evolution for nation was tribe, and then the next stage was nation-state, And then the ultimate stage was cultural nation that had dispensed with the trappings of state, that did not have a military, that could not threaten neighboring nations, that did not have a military claim to land, and that being diasporic was connected only by culture. And that's how he saw the Jews. And, you know, reading his writing in the early 21st century, I find absolutely heartbreaking, because that was his argument against the Zionist idea. And, of course, the other thing that fascinated me about the idea of Birabidjan is that there was a point, albeit brief, but there was a point when it seemed like the rational alternative to the zany Zionist idea, right? Why would you go to the desert where you were not welcome, where you would have to... The idea of resurrecting a dead language, of creating a Jewish military, all of that seemed so insane. And then there was the rational argument that Jews should live where they have become accustomed to living. They should enjoy the military protection of an existing state. But what they needed to do was they needed to take advantage of full citizenship while also having a hedge against assimilation, which was the price the Jews had been paying for full citizenship elsewhere in Europe. And this hedge could be cultural autonomy. That's the autonomous idea. And it's such a great idea, which is what really drew me to the story.
And the physical hardships that the early pioneers suffered were tremendous, similar to the physical hardship that the Zionist pioneers suffered in Palestine, but they had a lot more help, right, from outsiders and other things. But in addition to the physical hardships in Birabidjan, there really was in the early years a kind of attempt at flowering of Yiddish culture that then came to naught later. Could you talk a little bit about that growth of Yiddish culture as an expression of Jewish national aspirations?
Right. So the major character in the book is actually the writer David Bergelson, who's another nearly forgotten figure of Jewish history. But in the early 20th century and then in the interwar period, he was a major Yiddish language writer. And not just a major Yiddish language writer, but an organizer of the Yiddish language literary world. He was a publisher, he was a magazine editor, he was a convener of literary circles and circles of cultural activity. He was the convener of the Kultura League, which was the Yiddish language artistic collective in post-revolutionary Kiev. And Bergelson found himself in exile in Berlin in the 1930s, feeling very much the ill portents of German politics, looking for a place to go. He considered New York. He was a writer for The Forward, which is how he was able to lead a pretty nice life in Berlin, because he was making a dollar salary at The Forward. But ultimately, he thought that the United States was going to become a Yiddish desert. The Jews in the United States were assimilating. And the Soviet Union held out this promise of a real Yiddish cultural capital. And Birabidjan was supposed to be this region where Yiddish was going to be the state language. It was going to be a language of education. It was going to be a language of publishing, a language of literature. It was going to be the Yiddish center of the world. And Bergelson sort of bought his ticket back to the Soviet Union with his propagandizing in favor of Birabidjan in the diaspora press. So the reason, or probably the primary reason, that those Jews from California, as well as Jews from New York, as well as Jews from Argentina, went to Birabidjan, and altogether it was about 1,000 families who came from outside the Soviet Union, the reason they went to Birabidjan was because they read Bergelson's manifestos in favor of Birabidjan as a Yiddish cultural center. And it started out that way. There was Yiddish language education. There was Yiddish language publishing. There was a Yiddish language newspaper. There was going to be a Yiddish. Yiddish was going to be established as the state language once Birbijan was fully constituted as an autonomous republic. That was a status it never reached, because that project was scrapped in 1934 when the first purges began in Birbijan. Because the internationalist project ran up against the nationalist project, which coexisted in the Soviet Union like so many other contradictions coexisted in the Soviet Union. And when the nationalist project sort of got the better of the internationalist project, nationalism became a crime. And all these, basically the entire party elite of Birbijan was arrested and executed. And the project of turning Birbijan into an autonomous republic was scrapped. And Yiddish didn't exactly go underground, but the cultural project disappeared.
And the cynicism behind how Stalin treated Birbijan, you say the entire elite of Birbijan who were arrested and executed, they were arrested and executed for doing precisely what he had told them to do, which is try to revive Jewish cultural autonomy. And then they ran up against his Russification project. When was the final death knell struck in Birbijan?
I don't know that there's anything anything's ever final. I mean, you know, and this starts to get us toward the much more relevant topic of our conversation, which is, you know, everything unfolds over time. Nothing is ever the sort of the once and forever break with what you thought was going to happen. So Birbijan continues to be called the Jewish Autonomous Region to this day. All 1,000 Jews in Birbijan live in the Jewish Autonomous Region.
Out of 75,000 total people.
Oh, more than 200,000.
Really?
No, so it's less than half of 1%, yeah. But it's the Jewish Autonomous Region. So it was never quite over, except, of course, the dream was killed and many, many people were killed.
Both you and I were there, as you start out to say. You wrote about your trip to Birbijan in the book. You went in 2009. You called it a great falsification of history, a shtetl theme park, yes. Talk to us about your visit there, and I'll share some of what I saw as well.
So I tried to look for one of my projects in Birbijan was just going to the state archives, which was not a terribly rewarding project because the state archives were in the process of pretty much shutting down. It was easier to get access to archival materials back in 2009 than it is now, but even then it was very, very difficult. And my other project was looking for signs of Jewishness in the Jewish Autonomous Region. So I decided to look for Jewish food, and I don't know what your experience was with that.
I like Russian food, so I didn't look for Jewish food there.
Oh well, see, I lived in Moscow. I had all the Russian food I could wish for. So I decided to look for Jewish food, and I asked where I should go, and I was told I should go to the Chinese restaurant. And I went to the Chinese restaurant and I asked for the Jewish menu, and they said, well, it's been discontinued for lack of demand. So I looked at the regular menu and ordered the fruit plate, which arrived with a giant bowl of mayonnaise in the middle. When it was set on the table, the light bulb above my head exploded into the mayonnaise. Which, you know, I'm not sure it was anything specifically to do with Birbijan, but somehow it's been an unforgettable episode. I didn't give up, although maybe I should have. So I went to a cafe that was called something like the Birbijaner Cafe, and in the Birbijaner Cafe there was the Birbijaner Schnitzel on the menu. So I ordered that, and it turned out to be pork. I finally was told that there was a Jewish menu in my hotel. which you had to ask for special. So it was like a secret menu at Starbucks. But so I asked for the Jewish menu, and they brought it out to me, and it said Shalom at the top of the menu, and it had like four items on it, of which they only had one, which was gefilte fish. And then I watched, because I could sort of see into the kitchen, as they took the gefilte fish out of Manischewitz's jar and heated it up before serving it.
You're listening to journalist Masha Gessen, whose most recent book is Where the Jews Aren't, The Sad and Absurd Story of Birobidzhan, Russia's Jewish Autonomous Region. She's joined in conversation by Sue Fishkoff on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So one of the themes that you write about in your book is that Jews are always leaving, and they're never at home. And that theme of knowing when to leave, that Jews survive by knowing when to leave and knowing what to bring with them, is part of your personal history as well. You left the Soviet Union as a teenager of 14 with your family and came to this country. And then you went back to Russia, and then you left Russia 3 years ago to come back to this country.
Well, that was good planning, wasn't it?
you might rethink that now. But I wonder if you might share with us something about your upheaval at the age of 14 to come to this country and what that has to say about American Jewish misunderstanding of what Jewish identity in the former Soviet Union really represented.
Well, so when I was growing up, I knew what Jewish was, right? Jewish was probably not being able to get into the university of my choice, or possibly any university, having a very difficult time as early as elementary school, being singled out for being Jewish, getting beaten up a lot for being Jewish. That's what being Jewish was, right? Being Jewish was also a stroke of luck. It was very clear in the 1970s when I was growing up, because Jews could potentially get an exit visa. And when we got an exit visa and we came to this country, and we owed this ability to get an exit visa to the American Movement for Soviet Jewry. And of course, the premise of the American Movement for Soviet Jewry was that Soviet Jews needed the freedom to be Jewish. What my family and I and everyone we knew wanted was the freedom to not be Jewish, because being Jewish was getting beaten up and not being able to get into university. And that was our legacy. That was our heritage. It had been for generations. Nobody I knew spoke Yiddish or was observant. And in fact, not only did, my great-grandmother spoke Yiddish, but after my great-grandfather died when I was very little, she had no one to speak Yiddish to. And she very specifically told my mother and me that she would not teach us Yiddish because it would hold us back in life, right? It was this magical language that by dint of even knowing the language, you would be held back in life. Right? So the way to be a free person was to not be Jewish. And then, of course, when we came here, we were like all other immigrants from the former Jewish immigrants from the Soviet Union, greeted by very generous, very well-meaning American Jews who wanted to help us become Jewish, which was pretty much the last thing we wanted to do.
Did they take you to synagogue? Or?
Yep.
And since you have been a writer, your writing career, you've really written a lot about the dangers of totalitarianism. That's one of your major themes. It's in Birobidzhan, where Stalin figures as a major character. You wrote a book about Vladimir Putin, and certain parallels can be drawn to Stalin with Putin. Have you met Putin?
Funny you should ask. Yes, but this was not while I was researching the book. I actually wrote the book without having access to Putin because I had been blacklisted by the Kremlin for since Putin first came to power. But he apparently didn't know my name when I was blacklisted. I was blacklisted by some flunky. And then it so happened that in 2012, at the same time that the book came out in the West, I was editing a popular science magazine that Putin was very fond of. And then I was asked by the publisher to send a reporter on Putin's hang gliding adventure with the Siberian cranes. And I said no, because I didn't. This was not a principled journalistic stand. Actually, it was a very pragmatic plan on my part, because I thought if we don't send a reporter, then we were not going to see something horrible that we would then publish in the magazine that would get us shut down. Basically, being a popular science magazine, we can just look the other way. And I knew enough to know that when Putin carried out his nature conservation efforts, things usually went wrong. And so I said to my publisher, I don't want to send a reporter because something will go wrong and you are not going to want me to put it in the magazine. And he fired me. And then I tweeted about it. And then Putin called me on the phone and invited me to come in because he liked the magazine and he wanted to put it back together again. And not only did I think that when he called me it was a hoax and I should come up with something really funny to say, which I didn't. So I'm glad it wasn't on YouTube. But then when I went in, I thought, I was very excited because it was like going in to meet a character from my book, right? I had, in a way, I felt like I had made him up. Which is the way you always feel when you write a book, but especially when you write a book about someone you don't have access to, which I'd done a couple of times. And so this was this, you know, when you do what journalists call a write around, it's like the goal of that write around is to write the contour of the thing that you can't actually touch. And so I felt like I had created it, and part of me really wanted him to be different than the character I had written, because the character I had written was actually not terribly interesting. I mean, I think it's an interesting book, but the character himself is mediocre and not very intelligent and not terribly compelling. And the book had, in fact, been criticized for that, which I think is interesting in 2016, because some of the reviewers wrote quite explicitly that mediocre people do not become leaders of great countries. And that was what was wrong with the book. And then part of me wanted to be proven right. And I'm sad to say I was proven right. The guy I met was as two-dimensional and interestingly as uninformed as I had imagined. He knew very little about me. He had not been properly briefed for all sorts of reasons. But among other things, he didn't know about the book. Because in order for him to know about the book, someone would have had to tell him about the book. And nobody wanted to be that person.
So, and the criticism that you received for not making him into a monster, I see parallels between that and the criticisms of Hannah Arendt's book, the banality of evil, right? Seeing the idea of bureaucrats and the evil that mediocre bureaucrats and mediocre people can prove to be even more dangerous than pure evil. What is, if Putin is mediocre, what is the real danger of his regime and of the autocracy that he represents?
What is the real danger? I mean, where do I start? I think that...
And you're personally invested. When you wrote the book, you lived there. You were invested as a citizen, right? And it had more meaning and significance for you writing about that.
Oh, absolutely. And I also had to make a conscious decision while I was writing the book, because originally I thought we'd probably have to leave before the book was published. to be safe, and then I decided to stay. It so happened that the book came out when the protests, the mass protests, broke out in Russia. So all of a sudden, I was just one of many thorns on Putin's side, which I think is part of what kept me and my family safe for a while. Now, most of those thorns are in exile, and a few are in jail, and a few are dead. But I think the thing, what Hannah Arendt was trying to tell the world, and what several other great thinkers have tried to tell the world since, is that you know, mediocrity in power is not an exception. There's something quite tempting about the idea, you know, imagining evil as great. Yeah. And that's something, I mean, that's a theme that I've tried to approach as a writer at various times, including when I was writing about the Tsarnaev brothers, the Boston bombers, because I think that the premise of the war on terror is also very much about that. It's sort of, you know, if something is as frightening as terrorism is to us, then we take comfort in thinking that there is a vast army that is incredibly well organized, that recruits people and puts them through many paces for years before they become terrorists. To imagine terrorism as I think it actually works, which is that some ordinary people see a shortcut to becoming somebody and take it quite quickly, and their ideology is usually an afterthought, that's much more frightening. It's actually less frightening to think of something huge and monstrous than it is to think of something ordinary.
And here we are, 2016 in America, after an incredible election, talking about the danger of a mediocre person being given tremendous power. You have been writing about the election, most notably, the New York Review of Books published your essay, Autocracy, Rules for Survival. And you talk about six rules that you put forward as a person who is qualified to write about the dangers of totalitarianism because you lived for decades under such a regime. Could you go through what are those rules and why we should be afraid?
I'm not sure I can reel them off, but
Just talk through it.
Rule number one is, and I think this is actually the most important rule, is believe the autocrat. Because I think that what is happening here now, and this is quite familiar to me from Russia, and you know, I don't mean to say that Trump is exactly like Putin or even very much like Putin. They are, you know, there are obvious differences.
What are they?
Well, you know, Putin, first of all, was enabled by the fact that he came to power on the ruins of a totalitarian regime. Right? A lot of what he's been able to do, a lot of what he's been moved to do, and a lot of what's happened to society is are all consequences of his coming to power in a country that had not recovered from totalitarianism, that had not even really begun to recover from totalitarianism. So in that sense, that's a huge difference. Another significant difference is that Putin is not himself a charismatic leader. His entire charisma derives from the magic chair that he was placed into by accident. With Trump, that's not the case. Trump is a classic charismatic leader, right? So in that sense, it's much more useful to think about somebody like Mussolini, right? But here, this actually is getting me to something that will sidetrack us for a little bit from the rules for survival, but I think it's very important. I want to petition for the repeal of Goodwin's Law. Right, Goodwin's Law, as probably most of you know, is the imaginary law that says never resort to comparing people to Hitler or regimes to Nazism. Right, so I think we have to institute something like the opposite of Goodwin's Law, which is always resort to comparing Trump to Hitler and what's happening here to Nazism. And my argument is this, right? The world, in the 20th century, saw the rise of several autocracies. And I don't think, I'm not aware of an example of a country or a society that was able to resist the rise of an autocracy effectively. So maybe there's a way to learn from the failures, right? And that's also what qualifies me to write about it. Because, you know, it's not like we were so successful at resisting Putin. You know, here I sit in San Francisco talking about Putin because I can't actually talk about him in Moscow. But there's still lessons to be learned from failure. And maybe our conceit should be that, you know, if any country is going to be able to resist a clear and obvious danger, it should be this country. And to do that, we have to draw on the experience of so many failures of the 20th century and the early 21st century. So one of the failures is the failure to believe an autocrat, right? And I think it's a failure of the imagination. Because it's perfectly natural, because all we have to draw on is our experience. And so when pundits were first starting to talk about what Trump is going to do now, they were all defaulting to this idea that, oh, well, he's going to be just like a not terribly smart Republican president. Why? There's no reason to say that except that that's what they've seen before, right? There hasn't been a politician in American history who ran for autocrat, which is what Trump did, and won. And we really need to be listening to what he has said about what he is going to do, because that's as close as we're going to get to an understanding of what he's actually going to do. And again, this is something that we did with Putin. You know, Putin said everything that he was going to say when he was first running for office. But you would have people who would, you know, trying to prove to you that, oh no, he was going to be a Democrat and an economic reformer for no other reason other than they wanted him to be that, and they also couldn't imagine the worst.
Yeah, it's interesting you say believe the autocrats. During the campaign, when Trump was saying things like he's going to build a wall and he's going to have law and order the day after the election, people who supported him would answer, you know, interviewers would come to them and say, how can you vote for somebody who says these things, by saying, we don't think he's not going to do those things. That's, we're not voting for him because of those policies. We're voting for him because of what he represents. You know, the change, whatever. I might say that what he represents is the normalization of bigotry, and that that's the most dangerous thing, more dangerous than any wall that might be built in this country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it may not be entirely constructive to focus on something like the wall, because, yeah, obviously, the wall in the way that he has portrayed it rhetorically is unbuildable. I mean, he's not going to build it not because he doesn't want to build it, but because it's impossible, right? But what he the intention that he has declared is to launch a war on immigrants in this country. Right, to launch mass deportations. Mass deportations are perfectly plausible. They are going to happen. A war on immigrants is already underway. Right, I mean, his interview on 60 Minutes made that very, very clear. His appointment of Steve Bannon made that very, very clear. Right, this is the thing to believe. To focus on whether you know how many bricks he's going to use and how much of it is going to be chicken wire is just fruitless, and it misses the point.
What's your next project?
I'm working on a small book with a photographer, with a wonderful photographer named Misha Friedman, on the politics of memory in Russia. It's called Never Remember. I'm also working on a book which is in the proposal stages, which has somehow become a lot more relevant, which is called How to Derail a Democracy. Is actually looking at several Western countries, beginning with Israel, that have had major problems with the idea and the building of democracy.
The This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features journalist Masha Gessen, whose most recent book is Where the Jews Aren't, The Sad and Absurd Story of Birobidzhan, Russia's Jewish Autonomous Region. She's joined in conversation by Sue Fishkoff. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Yeah, would you care to comment on the Putin-Trump romance, and what do you think Putin wants to get from Trump? I hesitate to ask you what you think Trump will give Putin, because I think he'll give him anything, but what really does Putin want from Trump?
So I, I actually wrote a piece in July for the New York Review of Books, criticizing this conspiracy thinking and this portrayal of Trump as Putin's agent, because I think it was a very bad way of trying to come to grips with the very American phenomenon that is Donald Trump. Right? He's not a foreign agent. Putin's role in the American election is the same role that Russia has played in other Western elections, and in fact that the Soviet Union used to play during the Cold War, which was to try to destabilize and disrupt to the extent possible. Right? The Putin people reached out not only to Trump but also to Jill Stein, who, by the way, sounded exactly like an anchor from Russia Today whenever she was asked about foreign policy. I mean, I really got the impression that she was reading from notes.
She was the Green Party candidate.
She was the Green Party candidate, yeah. As for Trump, I think that that Moscow viewed him very much as a disruptive candidate, and they were as surprised by his victory as anybody else. I don't think this romance is going to last very long, and there are two very large reasons for this. One is that Putin actually needs the United States as Russia's enemy in order to maintain his popularity. He is running a mobilization society, and the only enemy large enough for Russians to mobilize against is the United States. Becoming friends with America all of a sudden is just not going to be good for Putin's support at home. And he's hooked in these, stratospheric, on these stratospheric support numbers, 82 to 86% popularity. So he needs America as an enemy. The other reason is more sort of a question of character. I mean, when have you ever seen two thugs get along? It's just not going to happen. I think it's going to be the shortest honeymoon in history. But I think before the honeymoon is over, it's likely that sanctions will be lifted. The sanctions regime is very fragile. It's very, very easy to lift, and it actually requires sort of consistent political will to keep it in place. So I don't think that's going to survive. And I think that there's a likelihood that Syria will be abandoned by the United States. Not that the United States has been particularly effective in protecting Syrians, but it's going to get worse. NATO is another issue that's very important to Putin and very unimportant to Trump. And this is also the maintenance of NATO is also a question of consistent political will. NATO doesn't rest on difficult to break laws. It actually rests on consistent renewal of commitment. And so it will be very easy for the United States to turn away from NATO. And that in itself, even if it's a symbolic gesture at first, will effectively give Putin free rein over whatever he thinks he deserves in Russia's immediate and not so immediate neighborhood.
So in your article, you talked about, don't feel safe about your institutions, right? They can also fail you. And then I guess as far as I know, the U.S. has the longest running institutions of this kind. Do you think, like, what would fraying of those institutions look like? What should we be watching out for?
So I think a couple of things. One is that a lot of American institutions actually haven't been terribly well maintained. Right? We have seen leading up to this election, you know, for the last 15 years, we've seen consistent concentration of power in the executive branch with ever weaker checks and balances on that. We have seen a totally dysfunctional Congress. So those are not great signs for what's going to happen. American institutions have been degrading for a number of years. The other area of risk is that a lot of institutions aren't codified in law. They rest on culture and tradition and even habit, right? So one of those institutions is the role of the media. There's no law that says that the White House has to have daily briefings. There's no law that says that the president has to have regular press conferences. There's no law that says who gets accredited to the White House. Right? It's all a question of habit. Vladimir Putin holds one press conference a year, one call-in show, and then occasionally, if he feels like it, he will hold another event. There's nothing to stop that from happening. And in fact, what we have seen already is, you know, Donald Trump has not made that many statements in the 6 days since he was elected. His first tweet was blaming the media for the protests. When he flew to Washington, he was the first president in recorded history who refused to take a press pool with him. Right, so that was the first precedent for denying traditional access to the media before he even is inaugurated. Not to mention that, you know, he banned the Washington Post from his campaign for months and threatened retaliation against Jeff Bezos personally for what he saw as poor coverage in the Washington Post. So I think we're going to see a crisis of that particular institution very, very quickly, and that's a cornerstone of the American system, right? Another area that is already at risk is protest as a democratic institution. We are already seeing this creeping delegitimization of protest everywhere, not just from Donald Trump, who again has been tweeting about how unfair the protests are. But even among people who are unhappy with election results, we sort of hear people saying, you know, why protest? There are no clear demands. He hasn't done anything yet. Give the guy a chance. Protest is an institution of democracy. It serves a lot of purposes, one of which is sort of affirmation of unity. And I think in our current situation, it also needs to serve as a sort of an affirmation of the current normal, right? I think that a very important statement for protesters to make is, this is where we stand. Among other things, we have a right to assembly in this country. And this is a right we're affirming now, because if this right is curtailed, we're going to take notice. But another thing that I find really jarring in a lot of American conversations is a basic confusion about what democracy is, right? Like, for example, when I talk about Putin, I will invariably get the question, but he's very popular, isn't he? Like, I don't answer this way, but I'm always tempted to answer, so what? Who says that that's important? Since when have we been equating democracy and tyranny of the majority? I mean, I thought it was the opposite, right? I thought that democracy was representation, which is the opposite of tyranny of the majority. But I think that basic conversation about what democracy is isn't happening in this country and hasn't happened in so long that there's a real lack of understanding. And again, in not just in Trump's rhetoric, but in a lot of in much wider circles, we hear this criticism of like, well, you know, if the people elected him, then we have limited right to criticize, when it's every citizen's duty to be critical of the government. And we take it for granted that the government is legitimately elected before we even start to criticize, right? That's an important democratic institution.
And I just want to take that question as well, because I would disagree that we're seeing a degradation of citizenship. In fact, I would argue that since this election, we're seeing an energization, an activization of the citizenship, of democracy in this country. I think we're going to see more of it. And at a very local level, and in our own Jewish community, we have you'll read about it in this week's J. Many, many synagogues this Shabbat dedicated their sermons to the election. They saw big turnout for Shabbat services, people wanting to talk to each other and not just commiserate, not just moan and groan, but really talk to each other. What can we do now? The Jewish Family and Community Services of the East Bay has seen a tremendous uptick in the number of volunteers, calls coming in from local Jews this past week to volunteer there to protect the refugees that have been brought in to this country, Syrian, Afghan, Iraqi, Muslim refugees that our Jewish institutions have brought to the Bay Area to resettle, and local Jews concerned that they may be targeted. And again, not sitting at home worrying about it, but stepping forward and saying, I want to volunteer, I want to do something about it. So that I see as something hopeful and good that is testament to the strength of our active citizenry.
So great that you're here. So I wanted to know how you got over or through this of writing a book about Putin and getting facts, and you're okay. You're here. You're alive.
Well, you know, the thing about any kind of terror, and certainly what journalists and activists have been subjected to in Russia, is terror, right? It's not, you know, Russia is not, it doesn't have state terror on the scale that the Soviet Union did, but certainly what the opposition is subjected to is terror. But it doesn't work by, you know, direct threat against every single person. It works by killing or imprisoning or forcing into exile enough people to get everyone else to shut up. You know, Russia is consistently one of the most dangerous countries in the world to be a journalist. If you go into the Committee to Protect Journalists website, you will see that it consistently ranks in the top 10, not just for danger, but on what they call their impunity index. Right? So not only are journalists killed, but no one is ever arrested and tried for their murders. But if you click through further and you look at a list that the Committee to Protect Journalists posts for every country, and you look at the list of attacks in Russia, you will see that you don't recognize any names. Right? The people who are really in danger are people who are not, you know, who don't write for the New York Times, right? Who can be punished with impunity. Everybody is dispensable to the government, but sort of the risk-benefit ratio to the government. There's no risk in killing journalists that most people have never heard of, or in beating them up. There's no reputational risk for Russia itself. But it gets the message across to other journalists, and the chilling effect inside the country is huge.
Yes, this was touched on a little bit before, but I'm wondering if you could just speak a little bit more about the specific potential for actions or responsibilities of the American Jewish community, because, and I'm bringing it back, obviously, to the current situation in the United States, because, you know, obviously, you know, we're a minority group, so there's a certain threat, but, you know, we have a certain protective sphere. We're mostly Ashkenaz community, so there's the sphere of whiteness, there's the sphere of our affluence and our protection in mostly liberal states. So I'm wondering, just in terms of the kind of institutional Jewish community, what you think we can do in the coming weeks and months.
Well, you know, we run the media, right? So so we need to be using that effectively. I mean, I'll take a quick stab at it, and then, yeah, Sue, if you can, you're probably much better situated to answer that question. But I'm used to thinking about individuals, and I think that, and I'm used to thinking about the media. So the media, I think, need to have a sort of pact, right? We need to really take stock of this, the rights that we consider to be important and inviolate. And before the drift begins, although the drift has already begun, right? The normalization has already begun. We really need to be aware of where our line in the sand is, and what we need to be protecting, and what we demand be respected. I also think Jews, as people, have a unique historical understanding of what it is to be immigrants. And considering that the first war that Trump has declared is a war on immigrants, we need to be out there talking about it, and fighting it every step of the way.
And I would say, look, 30% of the Jewish community voted for Trump, and I would dare to say that they don't want immigrants to be bullied, or they don't want to see swastikas on university walls. I would say that the Jewish community should use its privileged position to stand up for those minorities that are really being threatened. The woman at San Jose State University who is wearing a hijab, who was attacked in a parking garage by a man who pushed her and shouted anti-Muslim epithets at her. At Veterans Day parade in Petaluma, three men were waving Confederate flags because they feel it is okay to do that today. Graffiti in Pittsburgh using the N-word by people who believe that bigotry is now being mobilized. I think there's a tremendous task for the American Jewish community now to stand up with those who are really under threat, and it doesn't matter who you voted for.
So I would like to say I just feel very proud to be here at the JCC, where we have the opportunity to host these really timely and important conversations. Thanks to all of you for joining us tonight. Masha, Sue, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was journalist Masha Gessen, whose most recent book is Where the Jews Aren't, The Sad and Absurd Story of Birobidzhan, Russia's Jewish Autonomous Region. She was joined in conversation by Sue Fishkoff. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.